Hello, and welcome to the Television Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be spotlighting a television show or season that we think you'll find interesting. In this episode, I'm joined by my sister, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on Gilligan's Island that includes the three seasons, the New Adventures of Gilligan Island, the cartoon, the Gilligan's Planet cartoon, although I don't know, we'll say a lot about those two, and also the Rescue from Gilligan's Island, the Castaways of Gilligan's Island, and the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island. I think those are the names of the three movies they did.
Yeah, something to that effect.
But we're also going to spoil a book, and I'm going to start by really recommending this book because that's what actually prompted this episode.
Yeah, the book is incredible. It's called Inside Gilligan's Island, From Creation to Syndication by Sherwood Schwartz.
So the creator of the show basically wrote a book on here's what it took from concept to selling it, which was a big effort, to producing it, to getting the movies made, and kind of where it might have gone after that.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd gotten this out of the library, so I knew we had it for a short window of time on the Kindle. And I had started reading it one day at lunch. And the chapters are short. They're a real easy read.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, finish this. I want to see what happens next. Read the next. Read the next. I got through probably three or four of them on my lunch break. And then that evening, I finished the book.
And in the prologue, Sherwood Schwartz says, you know, he turned to the secretary he'd had for decades to help with the writing of the book. He went through his archive of files for dates and where he possible
fact-checked himself.
Yeah. Who was at meetings and stuff. And some of the stuff he has in there is fascinating just from if you ever wondered what does it take to create a show point of view. Some of it is fascinating from as a viewer. We thought this was in the show. We thought that was in the show. And getting either the confirmation or the, wait, you thought what? From the book.
Yeah. There were a number of aspects about the book that I found really interesting. At the end, it's got a kind of a synopsis or, you know, a couple of lines about every episode.
The appendix is fantastic.
And it's basically, here's the pitch for the episode, description of the episode. Here's the theme of the episode summed up in a word.
Yeah.
You know, cheaters never prosper, or, you know, whatever the thing was.
It's a 30-page appendix, give or take.
Yeah, and as a guide to the television show, the live-action television show, and the movies, I thought it was great. It didn't touch on the cartoons, of course.
No. But, I mean, just even taking for the pilot, Two on a Raft, and summing it up with a theme of imagined dangers are often worse than real dangers.
Mm-hmm. It basically had what is the, I don't say the point of the episode, but what's it trying to get across?
Mm-hmm.
And it gives it something that I think they could, as a production company, as a cast, stay true to if they had chosen to do that.
Yes.
But I was also amazed how groundbreaking Gilligan's Island was in a couple of respects. From the epitome of kind of the bottle show.
Mm.
It almost all takes place on the island. I mean, yes, there are dream sequences. There's a few things that take place off the island.
Go to NASA headquarters to get their side of the Mars rover equivalent that crashes on the island. That kind of thing.
Yeah. But when you've got, and this was one of the challenges he had selling it, if you've got seven people, how can you do an ongoing show with this? And one of the people at, I guess, CBS at the time, his version of the show was Gilligan's Travels, I think it was.
Yeah.
Of, and they take a different group out every time, and basically Sherwood Short said, well, let's just do it as an opening two-parter, maybe three.
Yeah, yeah.
And the minute they get bored, I'll get them off the island, we'll go to that next group.
Yeah.
And of course, they never did. But also, this show was shot in Hawaii.
For the pilot.
For the pilot. With out the characters and actors we know for the Professor, Marianne, and Ginger. They had a editor that was more beholden to the studio than Sherwood Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of, well, this is what I think the studio is going to want kind of a thing.
Yeah.
It got edited, it got re-edited, it got re-edited a third time.
Well, and going back to your point of, you know, who was the editor and the director beholden to versus Sherwood Schwartz, 4 pages of script got written behind his back.
Yes.
And filmed. And basically when he got to the editing point, he was told, and by the way, this 4 minutes is going to go on the screen whether you like it or not.
Yeah, here's the opening prologue to before they even get on the ship.
Yeah.
And he's like, that's going to kill it.
Yeah.
And he was right. But by the time he'd gotten to that third edit that sold the show, because it had failed to sell twice already,
this was
back in the day. It's not like today where you've got a digital file, you just click the mouse a couple of times, reorder stuff, do it 1,000 times, go back to your original file, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
This was physical film.
Yeah.
That you're literally doing with the equivalent of a razor blade and scotch tape to put it together. I mean, the exact tools are a little different, but it's the same idea.
Yeah.
Physically. And when it came time for that third edit, the editor basically said, this film can't take another edit and stay together. So they had to go to other shots from the dailies and other things like that, copy some of the film over and a few other things to re-put it together. And it paid off because it got the show sold. And because it aired and did kind of that, I think, typical J curve of it goes, it dips a little, and then it starts climbing. And when it got in that climbing stuff, it found its audience. It kept doing well. It bounced around on the schedule a few times.
Well, the initial episode that went on the air, he was saying in the book, wasn't the first episode he wanted to put on the air.
Well, it didn't start with how the castaways got on the island.
The network insisted he start with a quote, typical episode of them trying to get off of the island.
Well, and what I think was the payoff on all of that story was when Sherwood Schwartz later had, I guess, lunch with one of the reviewers who just hated the show. He's like, well, you know, what all have you watched? Turns out the guy had only watched the pilot. And not the setup and all that, but the first thing aired. And not even all of that, just maybe the first few minutes of it, and saw all he had needed to see.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow. Because after this show went off the schedule, and the story behind that.
That was priceless.
Was just a fiasco of errors that had nothing to do with the show whatsoever. It was just literally in the wrong time slot. Something else needed to get there, and those two shows were bumped. But after that, it went into syndication. When we were growing up, there were 2 episodes every, I think, Saturday and Sunday on, it was either KTLA or whatever the other LA show we got in San Diego.
Yeah.
But 2 of the indie stations or whatever, they needed to fill the air, and that's what they used.
Yeah.
So we'd seen the show 1,000 times.
When I was telling you before we read the book that part of why I picked it up, one of my friends has preteen kid, was at the birthday party for the kid, and I'm at kind of the adult circle, if you will, talking with the parents and grandparents, even generations, and the kid's cousin, who was at that awkward age between kid and adult, came over and decided to join the adult conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we were talking about at the time was TV shows now versus the TV shows we grew up on.
Yeah.
And how we felt a lot of the TV shows we grew up on, they had these themes to each episode. They had the moral to the episode. We felt there was meat, not just so busy making you laugh that they forgot to put a story in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, the kid, he clearly wanted to participate in the conversation, but we weren't giving anything to kind of hang his hat on. There was nothing.
Yeah.
So that's when I started bringing up I Love Lucy, Dick Van Dyke Show, Gilligan's Island. And when I brought up those 3 specific shows, he was able to jump into the conversation because MeTV shows them.
Yep. They're still accessible to the modern audience.
And when the parents and grandparents' generation realized that the shows that they considered their shows, here was a 10-year-old who considered these shows his shows.
Well, I think there is...
There's power in that.
Well, there's tons of power in that. But there's a cultural literacy aspect to our society that people who've come from other countries and move in, they haven't grown up on the same TV shows. The shows change from generation to generation. But there are still some shows from every era that, while everything else has been forgotten.
Yeah.
Like, people may have heard of Ozzie and Harriet and the Adventures Thereof, but haven't watched it.
Yes.
And that thing went on for, like, I don't know, 15, 20 seasons or something. But people are familiar with The Honeymooners.
Yeah.
I Love Lucy. Get Smart. Gilligan's Island. Just staying on the sitcom side of it. Mork and Mindy. Happy Days. Cheers. Night Court. Probably The Big Bang Theory. Friends. For more modern shows and stuff like that. But there are certain ones that are touch points, I think, still resonate with the modern audience and stuff, and are worth introducing our kids to.
Well, I think Golden Girls.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain shows that once they go off the air as a currently in production show, it's not just that they go into syndication. It's that they stay in syndication for decades.
Yeah, yeah. There are certain shows like that. Now, one of the things that I found interesting about how Sherwood Schwartz got the show put together and stuff, because there was the concern of people are going to tune in, they're going to be confused as to what's going on with this. He's like, don't worry, I can set that up with the theme song.
Yeah.
That had never been done before. So at one of the meetings, he had to convince the people at CBS it could be done.
Well, backing up ever so slightly, the agent he normally worked with didn't believe in the show.
This says a lot about Sherwood Schwartz and that agent, because his regular agent didn't believe in it, didn't want to sell it. And he's like, okay, fine. I've got this other guy who's been wanting to work with me. Would you be okay if I let him sell this? Because if you don't believe in it, you're not going to be able to sell it well. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, yeah, fine. So it sells through this other agent. And he ended up at one point getting almost kicked off the show.
Yeah.
I forget which agent that was. I think it was the...
Well, somehow the original agent ended up being the one the contracts went through because he was his agent.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when Sherwood Schwartz found out that when the agent says the lawyers have looked over the contract, go ahead and sign it. Turns out what they mean is the lawyers looked over the contract for the agency.
The agency lawyers looked over it and they didn't have any problems with it. That doesn't mean it's a good contract for you.
Yeah.
And his comment along that was, if you write a hit show, you need to write a second one to pay for the lawsuit on the first.
Yeah.
But in the meeting, he was trying to sell the thing out.
Well, it was the agent who was making all these appointments for him to sell it and everything. He called him like 2 days or the day before the meeting.
You've got a meeting. It's day after tomorrow, whatever. You got to have everything or whatever.
And he's like, yeah, I keep telling him there'll be a theme song. And he's like, no, you are no longer at the point where you can say there will be a theme song. You are at the point where you have to say there is a theme song.
Not that it can be solved, but that you have solved it.
Yes.
So he basically spent a day or two nonstop with a couple of buddies and stuff on let's get the thing together, got it written and stuff, and it was going to be a Calypso song.
Hmm.
And if you go on YouTube for original Gilligan's Island theme, you can find this.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad song. It is not the classic song you know of from Gilligan's Island.
Well, it was a 6-hour tour.
It was a 6-hour tour. There were a few other couple of changes here and there. The whole style of music was different. It doesn't seem like one that would have had the same resonance that the Gilligan's Island theme song does. The Gilligan's Island theme song is something that, again, we're at a point where eventually this will age out.
Yeah.
But I still think the majority of Americans recognize it, can sing along with it, and enjoy it.
It is amazing how often you go on a vacation anywhere near water, and you will hear people joking about a 3-hour tour.
Yep. And the original theme song, Sherwood had to sing that in the pitch meeting.
Yeah.
And not a singer or whatever, but it did it well enough that, yep, you can sell this concept in the theme song. And again, that had never been done before in a TV show. You look at Brady Bunch by Sherwood Schwartz, sets it all up there. Again, it's a memorable, recognizable thing. You look at other shows, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Yeah.
It's a great example. Quantum Leap.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a song, but it gives you the premise in the opening credits.
Yeah.
Same with Knight Rider
and
a ton of other things that, again, we take as almost commonplace or yeah, sure, that happens. I mean, for shows that still have opening credits, that's a whole nother thing.
Well, and Gilligan's Island had the end song also.
That invites you back to watch again.
Well, and really describes the environment of Gilligan's Island in a way that makes you want to be there.
Yeah. Well, and it's a, this little story is over, but we got more. They're still out there. There's more to go on. Mm-hmm. Come back. We'll entertain you again.
Yeah.
I'm really curious if the scheduling snafu thing that happened hadn't happened, it absolutely had gotten the fourth season.
Mm-hmm.
Would it have gone for fifth? How long would it have gone? Because they had a surprising amount of creativity, of inventive ideas on what to do with a very limited cast, a fixed set, essentially.
Well, in the book, Sherwood Schwartz points out that, well, at first he says, basically, the cast did anything and everything asked of them.
Yeah, they were fair game, it looked like, for everything.
And then he says, well, there was one exception. Natalie Schaefer actually had written into her contract no close-ups. You figure she was over 60 when she did the pilot.
She lied about how old she was, claiming to be younger, and had done it for the free trip to Hawaii for the pilot, not thinking it'd get picked up.
Yep.
Was not overjoyed when it did get picked up, but stuck it out through the show and did wonderfully.
Well, and because Sherwood Schwartz knew that she was just doing it because she'd signed the contract and hadn't been thrilled it got picked up, he says, you know, in the very beginning of season one, he wasn't writing huge amounts of material for her. And she came to his office at one point and said, look, if I'm doing this, I'm doing this.
Well, and she was picked because at one point in her career, she had done some comedy type stuff. It wasn't what she was really known for. But again, the whole section of the book on the casting.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Denver almost didn't get the role because of The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, where he played a beatnik.
Yeah.
And it's, oh, he's a little typecast, or he's not the writer, whatever. But they tested him out, and it's like, yep, that's Gilligan.
And Jerry Van Dyke was the one he had in mind for it, and he didn't get it because the same agent who didn't believe in the show and wouldn't sell it wouldn't tell Jerry Van Dyke, hey, you should go for it.
What I appreciated about all that stuff is Sherwood Schwartz and that agent parted on good terms and stayed friends.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah, even after Sherwood Schwartz basically said, you could have done so much better for my career, we're not working together anymore.
Yep. There were a couple of times the agent Sherwood Schwartz had, the one point he almost got bounced off the show because it was working him to death, and the agent said, that's bad for you. And he's like, no, don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, the agent was basically going behind his back trying to get him off his own show at one point. He found out at one point that the agent had had him sign a contract knowingly that gave someone else more royalties
than he got,
for his creation than he got. And that other person wasn't working on the show every week.
Here's a guy almost working himself to death on a show, and somebody else is getting more profit out of it than he is because of a contract. If you ever are in a position to have that kind of a contract, read it over.
Mm-hmm.
Hire your own appropriate lawyer to read it over.
Yeah.
It's just, you have to. So the fact that there weren't burnt bridges on some of that was impressive. But the whole story on the casting, how they got Alan Hale.
Yes.
As the skipper, and they knew that was a make or break.
Yes.
If you don't get the right person, the way he's berating Gilligan, he's got to be lovable, all of this stuff. Sherwood Schwartz knew what that character, that actor, needed to do.
Well, the Laurel and Hardy comparison.
Yes.
That he comes up with, which nails it.
Or Abbott and Costello, that kind of a thing. There are certain things with those comedy duos where you've got kind of the goofball and the straight man. And the straight man's going to get upset with the goofball, but only so far.
Well, and there has to be a core of love at the base of that frustration.
Yes. Well, and in the original pilot that didn't air, we learn that Gilligan had saved the skipper at one point when they were serving together in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it comes out is, you didn't save me, you just prolonged my agony, kind of a thing.
Yes, yes.
And there's, again, the dynamic between those two is what makes the show at times.
Yeah.
Just as the dynamic between the Howells.
Yes.
Is a key aspect. And the original pilot had two secretaries and a high school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It was not the professor Ginger and Marianne.
Yeah.
Now, one of them was referred to as a professor, one of them was called Ginger, but they were different characters. So when they went to series, and the book could have, and I wish it did go into a little more detail as to, okay, why were those changes made?
Because
there was nothing against any of the earlier actors or anything. I would have liked a little more clarity there.
Well, he was very clear that there was a lot of conflict between Sherwood Schwartz and CBS about this is a broad comedy, but the comedy can't be too broad.
They didn't know what show they were getting, and there was nothing like it before, so I get it.
Your billionaire is too wealthy. He can only be a millionaire.
Yeah.
What was the phrase that he used once in a meeting and basically felt forbidden to ever use again? Social microcosm, I think it was.
Oh, yeah. He was basically saying it was he was being a little more literary or academic than was appropriate for selling a TV show at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, this is a sitcom. Using phrases like social microcosm, don't ever do that again.
Well, and there was also an undercurrent, but it's spelled out in a few places on how the power dynamic in television production has radically changed from when this show went on the air to today with, you know, who has more power? Is it the producer of the show, the studio, the network executive, or who?
I would love to understand better what he was explaining happened just a year or two before or right around when he was selling the show about, I guess, the FCC came out and said that the network is, it sounded like, responsible and liable for everything they air.
Yeah. I think that's what leads to the fines they get if there's profanity or other thing on live TV, which is why we got the delays on award shows or you know, other live broadcasts and stuff. But how it really empowered the network.
Yeah.
In some ways that were bad creatively for shows.
Mm-hmm.
And when you add to that, you've got a network executive who sees a show that's close to what they think would work and tries to steer it to be what they think would work.
Yeah.
Again, Gilligan's Travels versus Gilligan's Island.
Yeah.
And again, this book is, I thought, a super easy read, a great insight into the show.
Well, and some of the things that the executives said, you know, well, instead of what you're doing, you ought to do somebody, one of the castaways is a bank robber and they don't really want to get off the island, so they're undermining everything. Well, they do have an episode where a bank robber hides out on the island.
Yeah.
So they did try to work some of the stuff in to appease the executives.
At one point, Sherwood Schwartz was apparently in a meeting. We love the show. We just have a few notes. And basically, they wanted changes in all seven of the characters.
Yes. Ginger is too beautiful and too famous.
Howell's too rich.
Yeah, Howell's too rich. I think Marianne was too much of a nobody, something to that effect.
And I think the professor shouldn't be as knowledgeable as he is or something like that. It's like they undercut all the characters. And he's like, no.
Yeah.
It's no longer the show.
Yeah.
And it was also interesting when it came time, the show had been off the air. He wanted to do a wrap up for it. Couldn't make that happen. Decade or so goes by. People are still getting asked, did the castaways ever get rescued? Did I miss the episode where it tied off? It's still an open question. He winds up dropping off something else, a script somewhere. Somebody asks, are you the Sherwood Schwartz who? And I always wondered if.
Mm-hmm.
Gets into a conversation. Head exec at that agency comes by. It's like, yeah, I'd sell that in an instant. Well, I've been trying to sell it for 10 years.
Yeah.
And that's what got the reunion shows going. At a time where reunion shows did not exist.
Well, and he talks about when they were filming the castaways coming into the marina in California, having just been rescued, and it's, you know, a real marina they're filming at. And he says, so there are, you know, real Joe Blow locals who are filtering in and around where we're filming and getting caught on camera, but they got so swept up in what they were seeing. You're seeing people crying on camera, and some of those are not our paid extras.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
again, it was an iconic thing, and if you actually recognized, oh, these are the castaways.
I loved when he says that when the show was on the air, someone from the Coast Guard
called. He got a visit from the Coast Guard of, I've got to come and explain this in person, and was showing them all the reports they were getting, telling the Coast Guard, go rescue these castaways.
Yes, they were receiving telegrams from people worried about the castaways and wanting them rescued. Surely the U.S. government could do something to help them.
Yeah, it boggles the mind on that one.
But it tells you how convincing.
Well, how invested people got.
Yeah.
It's not just that they saw these people, but they cared enough about them to want them rescued.
Yes.
And again, that longing in the American culture is what led to not only the reunion movie, where they get rescued and wind up back on the island and stuff. Again, we said there'd be spoilers.
Yeah.
But that led to a second one. It led to a third one, was almost going to lead to either a fourth or an ongoing series, where they were going to kind of turn it into almost a mishmash of Fantasy Island or The Love Boat or whatever, mm-hmm. where it's now a resort. Come here and have your problems solved, which I don't know if would have worked or not. I'm kind of glad they didn't try it, because I would have hated for that to run half a season and fail. Yeah. But when that first reunion thing hit, it did, what, like a 52 share or something?
Yeah.
It was like one of the most watched things on television ever, kind of a thing.
And then was it the second movie that the network decided to break the two-hour movie into two separate 1 hours?
Break it into two separate 1 hours by a week apart with the same listing, so people thought it was a rerun the second week.
Yeah.
And I thought one of them was also up against the OJ chase or something. Something on TV happened that kind of, it did much worse. It yeah. still did well, 27 share or whatever. But the first one did so well, that's when you started seeing a lot of other shows getting the band back together and getting a reunion out there,
mm-hmm.
which I think is wonderful. I think it's a lot of fun if you've got a good show. You know, I would love to see a couple of shows from more recent years get a chance to do a two-hour TV movie to either close things off or whatever happened to those characters or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a few times where that's been done where it's a little awkward. I think they did a Dick Van Dyke one, I don't know, 40 years after the show yeah. went off the air, maybe 50?
Something like that, yeah.
It was fun to watch, but again, a lot of time had elapsed.
Yeah.
But Gilligan's Island is, I think, a unique thing in terms of the type of TV it was, the impact it's had culturally, and again, the show was a ton of fun.
Mm-hmm.
The reunion movies are fun, not as good as the original stuff. I think the attempt to do it as a cartoon, setting it first on the island and then on another planet, it kept the property alive, not that it was struggling on that.
But that's one of the things that he explains in the book, was from his perspective, that was almost a way of saying, yoo-hoo, execs, you know, we could be making a movie.
Well, or more TV show, or there's mm-hmm. still an audience for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't want to crater doing another live action thing. But it was also smart when he was getting the deal put together for the reunion movie. It's like, I'll guarantee 6 of the 7 castaways.
Yes.
Because most of them, I think, jumped at the chance. Tina Louise, who played Ginger, had originally thought it was going to be a show about Ginger and 6 other castaways, which technically is correct. But there's the implication that Ginger was the star on mm-hmm. Gilligan's Island.
Yeah. And he never tracked down who gave her that impression.
I would expect, having no information whatsoever, either it was her agent or her hearing, you're going to be one of 7 castaways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's Ginger, the role you get, and there's 6 others.
Mm-hmm.
And reading more into that than there was. But he managed that expectation reasonably well. Everybody got an episode to kind of highlight in and stuff like that. So it's not like it, because if you look at the original pilot, Skipper, Gilligan, Thurston Howell,
yeah.
those are the leads. Everybody else is supporting. But her not coming back for the cartoons or the reunion shows, not too surprising, because this is the kind of show that both makes and breaks a career.
Well, I think she had a love-hate, Tina Louise, I think yeah. she had a love-hate relationship with it, because, yeah, it made her career, but it also meant she struggled to get other work after that, and she was young enough when this aired.
Yes.
She was at the beginning of her career. You know, Alan Hale had been acting since he was a baby.
Yeah, he'd been doing it forever, and he was old enough that getting closely associated with the Skipper didn't bother him at all, nor was it the sort of thing that should have bothered him at all.
Well, and his father had been Little John in the Errol Flynn Robin Hood movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he'd grown up knowing what it is to be closely associated with a character.
Yeah.
Having his father go through that and probably have a better idea how to manage it.
Yeah, and I think there's no way of knowing when you take a role. Is this going to be one that you do for a pilot, maybe 6-7 episodes, half a season or a year? And then 3 years later, it's like, oh, I don't even remember that show.
Mm-hmm.
Or is this one of those that you are permanently associated with, to the point that if it's not put on your headstone, somebody's going to carve it in there.
Yeah. Well, and Tia Louise was doing Broadway when they bought out her Broadway contract to bring her on the show. And there was a period where if you were doing TV, Broadway wouldn't look at you.
I think given the time frame and given where she was doing Broadway stuff, this show actually probably did hurt her career, even though it was successful for her.
It's kind of ironic.
I think the one that if I could go back in time and give one of the actors, not just give them advice, but get them to buy in on the advice, I would go back to Russell Johnson, who played the professor.
Mm.
Show's ending. Find a way to make him the professor.
Yeah.
In terms of PBS type stuff, he could have been the equivalent of Bill Nye the Science Guy, Mr. Wizard, half a dozen of those shows wrapped into one, where he's basically get some good curated content, have him explain it, get some kids, have some fun, and get the whole STEM thing going a decade or two sooner than it did.
Yeah.
Because he had just such a gift for making things sound understandable, believable, and in a way that few other characters on TV have really had that ability to communicate, be believed, and be liked.
Yes.
MacGyver, the original one, I think is another example. Beyond that, I'd be a little hard-pressed to name some.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, I think they got, I would say, the perfect cast together for the show. I think the only quasi-weak link, and Tina Louise did a phenomenal job through the show, but if you could have found somebody who did equally well and still wanted to go do the stuff afterwards.
Yeah.
Because the only reason Dawn Wells didn't do the first cartoon is she was doing a Broadway thing.
Mm.
She wasn't available.
Yeah.
But she came back and did the voice for Marion and Ginger on Gilligan's Planet and was back for all the reunion stuff. So I do think if you're an actor going in for a role and stuff, you got to find a way to balance the, this may never see the light of day.
Yeah.
It may see it flop and be forgotten, or I may be permanently associated with this character till the sun burns out.
Yeah.
And find a way to be happy with anywhere in that spectrum. And again, I think Gilligan's Island is one of those, because it was in reruns, because it was so popular, the catchy theme song, it's a very different kind of a show than so many other things. They managed to capture lightning in a bottle. It's not perfect. It's a little wacky, a little goofy, a little inconsistent in places, but it's fun.
But it has really solid messages.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of the early episodes are we need to work together to survive.
The overarching theme and message of the show, work together, let's all get along.
Yeah.
And we'll get through it all okay.
Yeah. And I can't help but wonder if it had been made 10 years later, if it would have had a more ethnically diverse cast, but if because it was right at the point of desegregation and all that stuff, if it was just kind of a, I'm fighting as many battles as I can, that's not one more I'm adding to the mix.
I think when it was done, there was the opportunity to be a little more diverse. Star Trek being an example. But it was not unsurprising or unexpected. It was not diverse. But I think if you were to redo it today, if you went with, okay, we've got seven people, let's cast as diverse a net as possible, there are ways to do that where it works. There are ways to do it with, oh my God, this is screaming diversity and nothing else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at what was being done in TV at the time it was made, because it was 1962, I mean, the Howells are a married couple that sleep in separate beds. And when we have episodes where, like, Gilligan, for some reason, has to sleep in their hut, we don't actually see Mrs. Howell sleeping in her bed.
Well, again, that period of television was, trying to think of how to even phrase this, to say it's provincial in their ideas, I think, is an understatement.
Yeah.
And Lucy and Ricky in I Love Lucy, separate beds.
Yeah.
And they had a kid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's certain aspects. And I think, I think some of that was just the signs of the times, what was acceptable then. And that is so wildly different now.
Mm-hmm.
And not, I mean, it's good that it's more realistic, representative, but there is a point where it's taken to the extreme too, these days. I think trying to do a modern version of Gilligan's Island. Certain parts would be easier because you could do it with virtual sets and some stuff like that. That could really open some interesting doors on what the island could be like.
Oh, I loved in the book when he was saying that they built the lagoon on a soundstage. Mm-hmm. And the CBS execs are like, yeah, and then we want you to land a plane on the island. He's like, the stock footage?
Yeah. Island does not exist. We don't know where that is. It's the one angle. That's all we got. Yeah. But again, these days, CG, you could do some wild stuff.
Well, and when you consider that that was on a soundstage and they did have an airplane get brought into the lagoon area. Airplane,
motorboats, one-man sub.
Yeah.
They set up the way they did their soundstage and all that really well, I think.
Yeah.
There was the cave location, the waterfall, the lagoon, the where the huts were, and that kind of, I don't know how much of that was planning or just adjusting as they went. But I think in today's environment, you would have to do it virtually. Doing it physically and planning it out, building your own lagoon and stuff, I think is a non-starter for a lot of shows these days.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to invest that type of time and money and whatnot. But I think finding not only the right set of actors, because it always looked like the seven got along, enjoyed each other's company, and were having a good time making the show. I think you could find that. Could you find people that were as perfect versions of the characters they portrayed? And part of it is we're looking at the Skipper with nobody else ever having played the Skipper.
Yeah.
But it's hard to imagine almost anybody else playing the Skipper.
Or Thurston Howell III.
Well, Jim Backus had done Mr. Magoo, I think, at that point and whatnot. So he had the voice. It was, again, certain of the characters were written for the actors. Certain of the actors were just perfect for the characters.
Yeah.
And some of them where you had a lot of wiggle room. Again, the Professor, Marianne, and Ginger were effectively recast and recreated from the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
The Professor, a little less so. But even so, I think the Professor in the unaired pilot was a little, almost more academic, a little harsher. He didn't have the personability or whatever that the Russell Johnson Professor had. Because there were times he would just look at Gilligan and it's like, how did this kid get through school kind of a thing? But he liked Gilligan.
Yeah.
They got along even if he was exasperated by Gilligan at times. And that kind of chemistry between the characters and the actors is what makes or breaks a show when you've got the seven and it's hard to bring in others. And granted, they did it all the time. But I would have a hard time imagining, if you were to pick through all of movie, TV history and stuff, could you find seven actors that would have been a better, either for each of the characters or a better ensemble? And then again, part of that's a credit to the work they did on the three seasons.
Yeah.
It was a fun show. And again, Inside Gilligan's Island, the book by Sherwood Schwartz, it was, for me, a page-turner. Because Sherwood Schwartz is obviously a good writer. He's able to be comedic without, you know, trying to write one-liners or whatnot necessarily. It was interesting from a process junkie behind the scenes point of view. It was interesting from, I know the show, I want to see how it got made and just what led to it going off the air, what led to it coming back, all of that. And it was insightful on that. And I started it on lunch hour. I read, I think most of it that night, and I finished it the next night. I may not have done it one night, but it was within like a 36-hour time frame, if not 24-hour or less kind of a time frame. It was really easy to keep going to that next chapter. They're bite-sized. They're easy to get through. They were informative. And just some of the little anecdotes on some of the miscommunications that happened when they were filming in Hawaii and some stuff like that. It's an entertaining read.
The challenges in calling your secretary.
Yes.
Yeah. Trying to damage the minnow enough that it would look properly damaged on the shore.
Having the bystander looking on like, that thing's not going to float. I know.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. It was fun. So definitely recommend it. And it got us to watch the original unaired pilot, rewatch the different openings for the season, see what they kind of changed and stuff. Hunt down that original Calypso version.
Yeah.
Worth listening to because it's in an alternate reality what the theme song would have been.
Yeah, it's kind of wild.
And again, the one that they used, it's catchy, it's fun, it sums everything up. It really checks all the boxes of what you want out of a theme song and added a couple of new ones that mm-hmm. just didn't exist prior to it.
Yeah.
So again, the fact that the show was just groundbreaking on a couple of technical and production levels and thought process levels, I really enjoyed that aspect.
Me too.
Anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.